You're listening to Root Cause Remedies, a show that explores environmental justice from right here in Hawaii. I'm Tina Grandinetti, and I'll be your humble host and fellow traveler on this huaka'i to learn more about the issues that affect the lands, waters, and people that sustain us. Ooh, our very first episode of our very first season. So exciting and a little bit nerve-wracking. Thanks for coming along on this ride. Like you heard in that little intro, I'm Tina and I'll be your host on this podcast. But there's also a whole team of badass women working behind the scenes. Shout out to Lauren, Carly, Anna, and Kristen for making this possible. Basically, we all came together with the idea that with so much happening right now, a pandemic, uprisings for racial justice, unprecedented unemployment, political divisiveness, climate change, et cetera, we needed a space where we could really explore the deep roots of all of these issues and how they're connected and how they've been connected, right? Because here in Hawaii, we didn't need a pandemic to tell us that we needed a radical shift in the way that we relate to land and the way we relate to each other. Because just in the last year, we saw this wave of inspiring and transformational movements for Aloha Aina all across Hawaii, from Mauna Kea to Hunana Niho to Kahuku. Almost 300 arrests were made against Kia'i in nonviolent direct actions simply to protect Aina. So one way for us to make sense of all of these intersecting and overlapping issues is through the idea of environmental justice. And that's kind of the starting point for this podcast. It's a concept that I have heard of, I'm familiar with, but that I've never really gotten to explore very deeply. So though I'm your host, I'm really going to be learning along with you and trying to make sense of what environmental justice means for Hawaii and how it connects to other sort of guiding values and ethics, like aloha aina, like malama aina. So for this, our very first episode, I had the privilege of sitting down for a socially distant talk story with the newly minted Dr. Kyle Kajihiro. Kyle recently earned his PhD in geography from the University of Hawaii at Manoa, where he also works as a lecturer in geography and ethnic studies. He's a longtime activist who I kind of think of as like a walking encyclopedia of social movements in Hawaii. And he will probably feel weird about me saying this, but I also consider him a mentor and obviously a friend. So I wanted to ask him what exactly is environmental justice and what isn't it? And how can an environmental justice lens help us to better understand the issues that are shaping Hawaii today? Think of this episode as EJ 101. I learned a lot from this conversation, and I hope you do too. So listen in. I guess the best place to start then is what exactly is environmental justice? Because it seems like the question is a little bit more complicated than we might assume, yeah. Because it's been defined in a lot of different ways by a lot of different interests.
So I think, well, first, I think you have to keep in mind the history of environmentalism and conservation in the United States. And it emerges out of a history of sort of during the progressive era when conservation meant preserving these quote-unquote wild areas. Mm-hmm. But it was very much premised on the notion of white supremacy and eugenics, believe it or not. And so conservation was about conserving nature for the use and enjoyment of white people, basically. And so there was always this kind of race, this thread of racism running throughout environmentalism. And we saw that in some examples when some of the big environmental groups I think in the 80s and early 90s, came out with some kind of Malthusian analysis about, you know, overpopulation being the threat to the environment, and also immigration to the United States being an environmental threat. And so they took some kind of reactionary lines on those issues. And so environmental justice emerged more out of community groups that were dealing with racial justice and economic justice in urban areas, but also, you know, in the kind of rural agricultural organizing that was happening with farm workers and with indigenous peoples. And I think they were developing in parallel with each other, but it began to come together under this rubric of environmental justice, partly, you know, out of the United Church of Christ doing a study and seeing that the factor that correlated most with exposure to environmental toxins was race. Mm-hmm. They thought that class and economic status would also be a factor, and it is to some extent, but the biggest correlation with environmental harm is race. And so this is where the term environmental racism comes from, and environmental justice being, you know, the kind of organizing that addresses these inequities that matter, the racial inequities that manifest themselves in the environment and the exposure to environmental harm. And one of the, you know, kind of foundational documents that comes out of this movement is the Principles of Environmental Justice, which I forget the exact year. I think it was maybe 1991 or 1992. And it was this convergence. 1991 in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. All these groups came together, including some representatives from Hawaii. Oh, nice. I believe Mililani Trask was at this meeting and other indigenous leaders. And so when you read this, it's a declaration of these really powerful, far-reaching principles that, like a declaration of human rights, but it affirms, you know, the sacred relationship with the earth. Mm-hmm. It affirms justice and mutual respect among different peoples. It talks about the fundamental right of self-determination in the political, economic, cultural, and environmental realms. It calls for an end to, you know, the production of toxins and nuclear waste, other kinds of harms to the earth and to communities. I think one of the things that's really interesting about this too is that it recognizes that indigenous peoples have kind of unique relationship with the United States government, mm-hmm. Of sovereignty, right? They have a sovereign relationship and that self-determination is a key part of environmental justice. So to be able to say no when something is threatening environment or cultural resources. And so this was the kind of the founding document that came out of the summit, and it has been kind of a guiding set of principles for the environmental justice movement, regardless of whether it's you know, indigenous peoples dealing with nuclear waste or contamination of rivers and salmon, or farm workers dealing with pesticide contamination, or you know, Black communities in the South living in the area that's called Cancer Alley, where all these chemical plants are located, and being exposed to, you know, this kind of chronic toxic exposure. And so these principles form an umbrella that brings all of these different movements together. And they organize locally, but also linking up through these various regional and national networks. The other thing that one of the principles also speaks specifically to the negative environmental impacts of the military.
Yes.
And so they had an explicit critique of militarization and its toxic impact on the environment and on various communities. So I think, you know, this is the kind of the spirit of environmental justice. Mm-hmm. But what happened after they were able to get more recognition from the government that this was an important issue, President Clinton signed an executive order requiring federal agencies to incorporate environmental justice analysis into their procedures, especially around environmental decision making, right? So when you do an environmental review of a project, it required that they incorporate environmental justice analysis. But the way environmental justice was defined by the federal government under this executive order and the way that it was implemented through administrative law, it was a very watered down version of the concept. I wouldn't even call it really environmental justice.
Yeah.
But
do you want to,
you know, it just it basically the, says that, you know, the harm
with you. Maybe you could read it. Because those 17 principles are just, I mean, you can't even say they're distilled down. They're just turned into one sentence, really.
Right. So this is the environmental justice for the federal government is the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all people, regardless of race, color, national origin, or income, with respect to the development, implementation, and enforcement of environmental laws, regulations, and policies. And it says fair treatment means no group or of people should bear a disproportionate share of the negative environmental consequences resulting from industrial, governmental, and commercial operations or policies. So you can get out of the statement is that one, it's just processual, mm-hmm. right? It's just dealing with a process, mm-hmm. and that you need to have meaningful involvement, whatever that might mean. But also it's just about fair treatment. So they're basically saying it's at the lowest common denominator that everyone should bear an environmental burden equally, which is not a very high standard, right? Yeah. It's not aspiring towards an environment that's healthy and sustains life and culture and the full in all of its fullness. It doesn't deal with the question of actual power. It says, you know, meaningful involvement doesn't mean that people get to say no or that they have to give consent to something that's going to affect the environment where they live.
Right. Like so, the principles explicitly talk about sovereignty and self-determination, whereas the U.S. government talks about meaningful involvement, like within the structures and processes that they put into place.
Exactly. And so when this kind of language gets, you know, kind of inserted into the environmental review process under like a National Environmental Policy Act, it just becomes another checkbox that whoever is preparing their environmental study has to do an analysis, right? And so what that meant in many of the cases that we encountered here in Hawaii was that they looked around at the demographics in Hawaii and they said, oh, well, there's no majority-minority culture, right? Everyone's a minority in Hawaii. So therefore, the harms of this particular project are distributed evenly, right? So they could check off their environmental justice analysis. And we kept saying, no, that's not the case. There are disparate harms, especially when you're dealing with a place like Hawaii that is Kanaka O'iwi land and who have an indigenous ancestral connection to place. Anything that happens to the land has a disproportionate impact on first their relationship with that land, especially when it deals with military land. And these are lands that were taken, right? They were stolen land from the Hawaiian Kingdom. That has to be first and foremost of the environmental justice impacts. But that was something outside the scope of what military environmental review could consider, right?
Right.
Because it unsettles their whole claim.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we were involved with the environmental impact statement process for Maco Valley from about 1998 until 2001 and beyond. And initially, the Army did not want to do a full environmental impact statement. They didn't want to set a precedent, which would require them to study all the impacts of their training and the kinds of, you know, destruction that it causes. So they produced a really thick environmental assessment. Mm-hmm. And an environmental assessment is considered a lesser kind of document. It's not as rigorous. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have all the requirements for community input, although they wrote it and created opportunities for community input as if it was an environmental impact statement, but they were still calling it an environmental assessment. And so, you know, we challenged that. There were huge turnouts. I think one meeting went until Anuwai and I at the gym lasted until about 2 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
People just giving testimony and blasting the Army's...
Oh, wait, hold on. Sorry to interrupt again, but mm-hmm. there's like scratching on your end from... I think your mic is rubbing on something.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Okay. So sorry.
And so the environmental review process, they have to consider, a couple of things that are often overlooked in these environmental reviews is environmental justice, right? And then also what's called cumulative impacts. Mm-hmm. And so we said, hey, you know, you can't just study this small impact that you're going to do from here on out, or limit the scope of your proposed activity so that it looks like it's going to have a minimal impact in order to justify the project moving forward. You have to consider the 50 plus years of, dispossession, the eviction of families from this land, the destruction of cultural sites, the contamination and unexploited ordnance that's going to affect future generations. Those are all part of the cumulative impacts that have to be taken into account. And if you take this all into account seriously, it would weigh heavily on towards the activity being, having a huge impact, and, you know, it would make the case that it should not be allowed to proceed, right? So we would argue on the grounds of cumulative impacts, but also environmental justice impacts. And so this is where the Army, they just looked at the surrounding community demographics, and they said, well, you know, there's no minority or majority culture or minority culture. Everyone's, you know, a minority in Hawaii. And so there's no environmental justice, disparate environmental impacts on a community. And we said, that's ridiculous, because this land is Hawaiian land. These resources are Hawaiian resources. Of course, there's disparate impacts that you have to consider. But because the law is written in such a way that only looks at whether or not harms are distributed fairly, mm-hmm. they were technically within the bounds of what's legal, but not necessarily within what's right morally and ethically for mm-hmm. the government to do, right? So that's an example of why this framing of analysis is really weak. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's done what it's supposed to do, which is really to empower communities to have a say in how their environments are affected by, government activities. And that's a self-determination question. That's a question of power, really. And when you look at the way that the federal government defines environmental justice, they still retain all the power, right? It's just about having a consultation in the process to involve more people. And so right. I think that's one of the big shortcomings of how environmental justice has been incorporated into actual decision-making procedures.
Well, yeah, because it's interesting, like in the principles of environmental justice, it explicitly says environmental justice opposes military occupation. So right. in the case of Makua, exactly. you can't, like, there's, you wouldn't even have to measure impacts because it's a military occupation, which is fundamentally an injustice.
Right. I mean, you know, it's fundamentally a dispossession. It's an imposition and an occupation of land that doesn't belong to them. So the violence is already inscribed in the relationship, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's on that basis that should, you know, that's why we're saying it had, the land has to be cleaned up and returned. But right. those fall outside the scope of what at least the federal definition of environmental justice can actually address. And that's how the Army and all these federal agencies typically write off the environmental justice concerns as falling outside, you know, the narrow scope that they use for their analysis.
Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe that's a good segue to kind of think about how environmental justice resonates with the movements for Aloha'aina that we see yeah. erupting across Hawaii today. Because for me, in many ways, the term environmental justice is less familiar to me than Aloha'aina.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like there's a lot of deep connections there. And so how are they different and where do they intersect? Or how can yeah. an environmental justice analysis help us to carry forward these movements for Aloha'aina?
Yes. No, that's a really good point, because when I came back to Hawaii, that's one thing I noticed, is that environmental justice wasn't deployed as a kind of a framing for a lot of movements. And yet all of these Aloha'aina movements, like you said, are dealing with concerns, right? Mm-hmm. Going back to Kaho'olawe. And so that was always really interesting to me. Kaho'olawe was dealing with desecration, was dealing with environmental, you know, destruction. They were dealing with unexploded ordnance, which poses a risk to, you know, life and safety and health. But they didn't really address chemical contamination very much on Kaho'olawe. I thought that was a very interesting thing. Whereas Makua Valley, when the formation of Malama Makua in the early 90s, the key issue there was the Army disposing of unexploded ordnance in the valley in an open burn, open detonation site, where they would just pour jet fuel on some old munitions and just burn it, blow Jeez. It up. And so all those chemicals were going out into the environment. And so that became the kind of focal point of some of the earliest activities of Malama Makua, was dealing with the chemicals. So it more readily merged with environmental justice concerns of on the continent, because they were dealing with toxins. And then you had other groups and other individuals on the west side of Oahu, anti-Frenchy De Soto, you know, one of the longtime, the kupuna who was involved in Kaho'olawe and a leader in Waianae. She kept talking about environmental racism, because she pointed out, you know, all of these contaminating industries and activities were being pushed into Waianae, which is one of the poorest and communities with some of the highest rates of, you know, various kinds of social dis-ease, but also, you know, one of the largest Hawaiian communities anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And here you have, you know, the landfills, the power plants that emit, air pollution, the military land use, chemical weapons dumped in the ocean, you know, unexploded ordnance in the land, the theft of water for the plantations, the illegal dumping. So there are all of these things just being piled onto Waianae. So she started to articulate that as an environmental racism issue. And that was something that, you know, we were also articulating and demanding that those questions be addressed. I think Aloha'aina automatically includes environmental justice. It's just that some of the tools of analysis
mm-hmm.
that are a little bit more technical and maybe more dealing with some of the legal and administrative frameworks, some of that didn't quite make it over, in the early phases of Aloha Aina activism. But now that, you know, Malama Makua and other groups have begun to incorporate that, I think it's much more, there's much more of a conversation between those different frameworks. Mm-hmm. And they totally are encompassed. I think that when we're looking at environmental justice too, though, we can also include other groups besides Kanaka Maoli, right? So
yeah,
that I think that that's important, because when we're dealing with like plantation agriculture and all the chemicals that were used in that industry, those things have persisted in the environment, and they're affecting groundwater. They're affecting, you know, people's health in the surrounding communities. And often, you know, homes are being built on this formerly used agricultural lands. Mm-hmm. So there's pesticides and things in the soil there that haven't really been analyzed, and I don't think adequate measures have been taken to ensure that people were not exposed to toxins. Right. So those are all places that intersect with other communities, and I think, you know, we can. It's an opportunity to bridge indigenous claims, indigenous politics, with those of immigrants and other people who live in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
It also helps to bridge with environmental issues in the workplace. So, for example, like I said, farm workers, right, plantation workers, but even of people working in industrial facilities or in hotels. Hotel workers, especially those in the back of the house who are doing cleaning using those kinds of chemicals, that's an environmental justice issue.
True.
Right? And so the principle of environment, these principles of environmental justice include environmental concerns where people live, work, and play.
Right.
Right. So it encompasses the whole of our lives and the environments where that happens. And it's not just a pristine nature, you know, where people are not included in that picture.
That makes so much sense to me. And I feel like that kind of leads us to this distinction between environmentalism and environmental justice. Because if you aren't super, if in just everyday conversation, you might hear those two phrases and not recognize that there's like significant tension at play between them. So can you kind of talk a little bit about that? What is environmental justice, but also what isn't it?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think, you know, environmentalism, for the longest time, I think people associated that with nature, right? With quotation marks around it. And that nature is somehow pristine and wild, and it includes plants and birds and insects and everything else except humans, right? It was a vision of nature that excluded humans. And yet, when we really look at the history of all environments, there's no environment that hasn't been touched by humans in some way, right? So I think a more critical analysis of the environment sees that it's produced in this kind of relationship that includes human activity.
Mm-hmm.
This is where the environmental justice critique sort of diverged from mainstream environmentalism, because it said you can't have a misanthropic or a Malthusian view of people. People are part of the environment.
Yeah.
Right. We need a more sustainable way of living with the environment. I think, again, so this goes back to that critique of the kind of eugenicist and racist strand within environmentalism in the U.S., at least, that excluded people. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a key difference with environmental justice and environmentalism. Let's see. I think too that, so environmentalism, since, you know, the first Earth Day in 1970, and it's grown, you know, there are some large environmental groups that make a lot of money, right? Mm-hmm. So it's become a whole nonprofit industrial complex. to protect the environment. And you can create poster, you know, images of seals or whales or whatever kind of wildlife, the charismatic, you know, images of nature that can sell your product, which is, you know, environmental protection. But often it doesn't include people. And so I think, you know, environmental justice was an intervention. It was a kind of a challenge from these grassroots groups that were saying, no, you need to, you know, people are part of the environment and we need to be a part of the solution. But the once that became sexy though, to funders, then we started seeing the kind of a co-optation also happening, which I thought was very interesting, and it became really problematic because certain funders would fund what they called environmental justice, but they didn't like how radical the grassroots groups were, right? Because these groups were talking about, they were challenging capitalism, they were challenging, you know, pollution, industrial and military pollution. And so these funders that were more liberal, they would fund alternative community groups and call them environmental justice. But their politics would be much more watered down. And it was a way of competing for that terrain, that that political terrain of what counts as environmental justice. And we saw some of that, you know, playing out here in Hawaii as well.
Can you think of a story that you wouldn't mind sharing? Or is...
I mentioned Waianae being, you know, kind of a hotbed of environmental racism and one of the sites where environmental justice has been most clearly articulated in the community activism. So one of the groups that's been doing it consistently is the Concerned Elders of Waianae, group of aunties from the community who research land use permits, environmental review laws, all kinds of stuff related to various sites in the community that they where they see a problem, and then get on it and start, you know, pushing decision makers, getting involved in contesting these decisions. And so they've stopped illegal dumping, they've stopped illegal landfill or excavation. They've done all kinds of things to try to protect their community because they see the harms that it's causing. And so, you know, I would say if we're going to talk about any environmental justice work in Hawaii, they would be at the top of my list of people who are experts and who are actually walking the talk. So a few years ago, well, I guess it was about more than 10 years ago now, the American Friends Service Committee worked with some graduate students at UH in public health and social work. And we did some research on trying to map and understand where environmental justice issues were in Hawaii, especially related to military and impacts on Native communities. And so one of our interns did all this research and trying to find how public the health statistics correlated to environmental known environmental hazards. We were looking specifically at the Waianae community. It was really hard for us to get actual statistics from the state. The cancer registry would not give us data that was specific to certain zip codes. They would just give us for the whole county of Oahu, Honolulu. And so there was no way to know like what part of the island was facing more cancer risk. Same with some of the other key environmentally linked diseases. The only one we could get geographically disaggregated data was for asthma. And the Waianae district, especially the Lualualei area, had the highest rates of adult and childhood asthma. And that correlates with, you know, areas where there's the industrial and construction landfills are in the area with the wind blowing, the trade winds blowing over the community. And so there's always been concern about the dust that accumulates in people's homes and the possibility that they're being exposed to contaminants. And then, you know, the asthma statistics bore that out. And so we started working with, we did a youth project over a couple summers where they would do some organizing around environmental justice. We knocked on doors in those neighborhoods, did surveys, did some community mapping of both the things that were precious about Waianae that we wanted to preserve, and also the things that were harming the community and the environment, and did an accountability session with some of the Department of Health people. The following year, we made a film with the youth. And so the concerned elders were kind of our partner in the community. We would work closely with them. So the first year that we were doing this outreach, we heard that suddenly there's some money from the Environmental Protection Agency that was being awarded to a large nonprofit who had no kind of history of working on these issues. But they got money that was going to be addressing some environmental justice concerns, and they were going to do a press conference in Waianae to announce this award to this group. And so we showed up there, the youth, and listened to their press conference. And what was so infuriating about it was that here was this large nonprofit that positioned themselves to get money that should have gone to the grassroots, people who are actually dealing with environmental justice concerns. They put in a grant, were able to get it, and all they were going to do was stream cleanup on four streams in the Waianae area because they said that was the environmental concerns in the neighborhood. And we're saying, well, what about the military? What about all this industrial, you know, harm? And they weren't willing to look at that stuff. So there was another nonprofit that got an environmental justice grant from the EPA. And they do some great work in environmental education, but they had no kind of clue about what environmental justice was. So the grant that they got was basically to do green jobs training and mentorship for youth from, you know, the West Side neighborhoods. So basically economic development with a green twist to it. But they weren't dealing with questions of power in decision-making about the stuff that was actually harming the community and the environment. And so those are two, you know, cases where this sort of watered-down notion of what environmental justice is becomes a kind of a resource for certain environmental groups that are doing liberal conservation and green economic development without really building community power to affect key decisions, right? And I think that that's the injustice in that type of environmentalism posing as environmental justice. Because they're stealing the resources that really should be going to the aunties of the concerned elders of Waianae.
Right. Yeah.
But instead it's going to this nonprofit, paying their execs, you know, paying their overhead and so forth. And the state, there was a bill that was introduced by, I think it was Colleen Hanabusa when she was a representative from Waianae, at the insistence of the community, right?
Yeah.
So it called for the state to strengthen its environmental justice response. It got watered down into the state doing a study of environmental justice needs. And so they hired a consultant who had no clue. This consultant did not even know about the principles of environmental justice, right? But this is the person they hired to do the study for the state about environmental justice. And we confronted this person in their office and said, well, what are you going to do about this? How are you involving the community? You need to come out to Waianae and listen to the work that's already going on. And this person was resistant to even doing that because she called it, she didn't want to be, how does she put it, another bitch session.
Oh, my God.
Right? She thought it was just going to be people making complaints, right, and was not going to be productive. And she just wanted to talk to the people who were knowledgeable. We said, these are the people who know it best because they're fighting this issue. So we called a meeting. We said, we expect you to be there. She showed up at this meeting, and I think she saw dollar signs in her eyes.
Right.
And then became the coordinator for this grant that I mentioned earlier, right? So they saw that there was a need. They were able to get money from the EPA. And they did nothing to actually address the fundamental issues of inequity, of power, of racism in the community. Mm-hmm. And so that's how environmentalism kind of pimps the poverty in our communities and cause it environmental justice without actually empowering those communities.
Yeah, so you keep saying like it's a question of power.
Yes.
Which I think is, sometimes when we talk about power, it becomes like we don't necessarily know where it's coming from. Who do we shift it? In this case, we know who to shift it to, right? Like shift it to the aunties, the people who are the most impacted, the communities that are actually dealing with the impacts of all of these environmental issues. But what do you see as the major structures or institutions that are holding power? Who do we have to take power from? Who are the people that are upholding these injustices against Aina and our communities?
Well, so, I mean, it's a complex assemblage of actors, right? But I think we can sort of focus in on a few key ones. So politicians and the individuals within these agencies that are charged with protecting environment, with development, planning and permitting, both at the county and the state level, at the federal level, the environmental regulatory agencies like the EPA, the state DLNR and Department of Health, they all have responsibilities to uphold these laws, but often they are basically bought, their influence is bought by corporations.
Yeah.
So you have, you know, the developers, the some of the unions who get, who do construction, who invest in the construction industry, economic interests, you know, have their fingers in the pot in many ways, right? And so on the Land Use Commission and the planning and permitting offices, they're often influencing the outcomes in ways that benefit their membership or their economic investments. And those are some of the places that, you know, we need to shine a light on, we need to hold accountable. And we need people from these affected communities having real say in what goes on that affects their environments, right? And it comes down to, if we look at some of the United Nations, what is it called? The Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. One of the prime directives, if you will, is free, prior, and informed consent to activities that will impact indigenous land, environments, resources, you know, cultural practices, and so forth. And that's what doesn't happen in all of these cases. It's a case of things being done to Native Hawaiians or to communities without free, prior, and informed consent. Or if they do any kind of consultation, it's framed as a consultation. It's not actually decision-making power on the part of the community to say no, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, I think that's where, you know, the key, we can see the essence of the problem is when these interests can impose their will and their desires on communities that have to bear the brunt of the environmental cost. Whether that's kahuku and windmills,
yeah,
or Waimanalo and you know, recreational fields that they don't want, or Mauna Kea, you know, and a giant industrial telescope that desecrates you know, a sacred place for Hawaiians.
Okay, I'm going to do a big question. So if we're really talking about the self-determination of impacted peoples in Hawaii, can you separate environmental justice from sovereignty?
I don't think so. I mean, I think when you come down to it, we are talking about sovereignty. We all are talking about the right to be self-determining. So I think we need to expand our thinking and practice of what governance means beyond just these kind of regulatory, you know, check the box, make sure we're in compliance kinds of governance of the environment, because that allows all kinds of violence to happen. Right. You know, because you can check the box doesn't mean that it's actually sustainable or sound or environmentally just. And instead, I think, you know, we need a more holistic relationship with the environment. This is where indigenous science and indigenous knowledge is way more advanced than in the West, because it's based on a relationship, right? It doesn't assume that the environment is a thing. It assumes that it's a living relation that you have to be accountable to and responsible in your interactions, right? And so to say, you know, to say that a mountain or a river has rights, now that changes things. Mm-hmm. And that means that the tradition, the people who have the deepest connections to these places should have the most say in what happens, right?
Yeah.
Because they're in relationship to them as family and kin, and they have a special relationship as caretakers of these places, right? And I think that that's more where we need to be going, especially if we're looking at the earth and the crisis we're in with the climate change. Capitalism is out of balance. It's intrinsically a system that requires taking more than you need and accumulating. So, you know, it's brought us to the brink of ecological collapse. And I think now we need to really rethink those priorities. And the pandemic is kind of forcing that upon us in many ways.
Yeah, it's so unbelievable how willfully, like, how unable our capitalist system is of seeing that connection between people and the land that we live with. Like,
yeah.
I mean, we feel it in our everyday lives, but somehow when it comes to governance under capitalism and settler colonialism, it's like that connection completely vanishes.
Well, it's just, you know, the basic logic of capitalism is has that flaw in it, right? It's a contradiction. Mm-hmm. I went to a talk one time by Winona LaDuc, so she's the Ojibwe activist and leader, and she said capitalism is primarily about accumulation, which means taking more than you need. Whereas indigenous economics principles are about a mutuality, reciprocity. Mm. It's about a mutual exchange. If you're going to take something, you have to give, right? Which means you maintain a sort of a balance and an accountability, which doesn't exist in capitalism, right? It's about, it begins with a violent dispossession. The primitive accumulation begins with taking land from somebody else, right? Depriving people of their own labor so that they have to work for you for pay. So there's all these dispossessions that happen in order for the capitalist to have the wealth to then invest, right? And keep accumulating it. And I think that there's a kind of a fundamental violence and inequity in it. And I think this is where we have to reorient our priorities if we're going to have an earth to live on.
Yeah. So as we're kind of confronted by so much uncertainty with this pandemic and realizing how fragile the systems in place actually are, what do we want to, as we watch it kind of crumble, we can see the cracks starting to form. They become clearer than ever. What do we build in its place? Like, we often think about this kind of work as fighting against something, but it's definitely so much more than that. So in your wildest dreams, what kind of world do we build in order to realize environmental justice?
I think we have we have Kipuka, we have these oases of the possible futures that we might want already in existence. Places, you know, that are practicing aloha aina, malama aina, that are practicing, you know, community empowerment and governance that are based on these kind of principles of reciprocity. We saw examples of that at the Pu'uhonua or Pu'uhuluhulu, mm-hmm. where the authority was not, you know, government with its monopoly of violence. It was the kupuna.
Yeah.
And it was cultural values that everyone felt compelled to uphold, right? And it wasn't anyone saying you have to do this thing. And but it was, that was the expectation, and we saw how it helped, and we, you know, people were being fed, people were getting education, they were cleaning up and keeping this place, you know, maintaining and caring for the environment. And so I think that you know, even though it was a kind of a small moment in the scheme of things, it gave us a glimpse of what other kinds of governance might look like. And what benefits can come from having a different kind of ethic of care. And so, you know, the metaphor of kipuka in the Hawaiian sense is also the place where the forest regenerates itself after the lava flow. And, you know, thinking about this pandemic, Arundhati Roy talks about the pandemic as a portal. So a portal is kind of like a kipuka, right? It's an opening into a different reality. Mm. And so we can see the possible futures that we might need to move towards in a moment of crisis like a pandemic, where the system kind of grinds to a halt or is hobbling along, and we see the cracks, and it's no longer, they've pulled the veil away, I guess, of the sense that this system is inevitable, mm-hmm. right? We can now see that it is fallible, it is fragile and unstable, and it produces insecurities all over the place and precariousness. So now we can, you know, I think in those cracks, that's where we can peer through to the other side and see other possible futures that we would prefer and that we need, actually. Mm.
Can you think of one of those cracks or kipuka or portals in your own life since the pandemic started?
In my own life, well, I've just, you know, tried to cook more and spend time with family. And, yeah. You know, I got a CSA box from Ma'o Farms. And that's been great to get, you know, just fresh local produce and thinking about more intentionally about, okay, who is producing our food? Where is it coming from? How are we using our spending to support those local economies? Yeah. And so I think those type of things, I at least in my own life, but also I see it around me and, you know, other friends, we've had to reorient, and it sort of shifts all of our sense of priorities.
Yeah.
You know, where that is become something of value, both for the quality of what you're getting as far as the food, but also knowing that we're investing back into our community in a way that is more sustainable in the long run. So, and then seeing how, you know, tourism, and by winding down some of the economic activity and all that noise, mm-hmm. You know, things are like, fish are coming back. Honu are nesting on Waimanalo Beach because yeah. there's no RIMPAC exercises coming up, amphibious landings coming up. And so, yeah, I think, you know, we're seeing the benefits of that in a very short amount of time, mm-hmm. that nature is resilient if we work with rather than against those natural forces.
Beautiful. I think even, I mean, to kind of carry through the spirit of not separating between nature and people, even like people are returning to the beaches, like,
right,
you know,
right.
Places that felt off limits because they had been kind of handed over to tourism, local families that might be suffering in other ways because of unemployment and stuff. They're also paradoxically, like having more time to go fish with their kids or, you know, that kind of thing. And yeah,
exactly.
I find that so beautiful.
And it's a much more kind of balanced relationship with the environment when mm-hmm. you're going and you're just fishing for subsistence. You're going to the beach mm-hmm. with family and or enjoying hikes or whatever. And it's not something that's being done for profit.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not driven by that machine in the same way. So yeah, exactly.
Oh, beautiful. That was such a nice conversation. I did you want to add anything else? Any last thoughts?
No, just thanks for having these podcasts and these conversations. I think environmental justice is a really important issue. Like, as we're thinking about climate change, you know, climate justice is environmental justice. Mm-hmm. Having safe workplaces, like not forcing workers to go to work or children to go to school in the middle of a pandemic where they could get sick and could die. Those are environmental justice issues. Absolutely. So I think all of these things come into focus in times like this. And it's important that we have these conversations and that we are oriented around, I think, some of those key principles, right? Mm-hmm. Around what does the justice part of it mean? It really does center around...
See, I told you, Kyle's like a walking encyclopedia. Thanks to him, I think we all just graduated from Environmental Justice 101, and I have no doubt that we'll be bringing him back to talk more one day soon. Mahalo, Kyle, and mahalo to all of you for listening. Stay rooted.